Fraulein Judas, C.P. Donald Jr. Camp Greenwood is for people who like to rough it in log cabins with French windows and tiled baths. It occupies a lush clearing halfway up Apple Orchard Mountain in the soft, purple Blue Ridge Range northwest of Lynchburg, and the fried chicken served in its pine-paneled dining hall is not a dish, but an experience, like love at first sight. Over a platter of this unrivaled chicken, Martin Rice scowled at me. Not a personal scowl, simply an expression of his attitude toward the human race, of which I happened to be the nearest unit. I countered with a smile. Rice and I had every reason to be gay. The Rhys Eccles report, offspring of Martin Rice's peculiar brain and my own crudely efficient typing, born paragraph by paragraph over 3 days and nights of paralyzing mental labor, reposed in my inside pocket and crackled reassuringly as I speared another chicken breast. Tomorrow, Monday, we would leave Camp Greenwood for Washington. There I would deliver Martin Rice and the Rhys Eccles report into the hands of Colonel Stephen Caspier, chief of Section 5, who would start them on their way to Great Britain. In Britain, the Rhys Eccles report would undoubtedly start something. My smile broadened as the chicken breast parted obediently under the affectionate stroke of my knife. Martin Rice was alive, the Rhys Eccles report was completed, and Colonel Caspier was a false prophet. He had predicted trouble. It had failed to materialize. No shots from ambush, not even a hellish attempt to sabotage my typewriter ribbon. I would prick him with that one tomorrow. No, I would say sweetly, not even an attempt to sabotage my typewriter ribbon. And he would squirm. Caspier had hinted, through chocolate-stained teeth, of possible action by one Maria Henken, who I had gathered was a sort of Gestapo superwoman. Description of Maria Henken? None available, Caspier had muttered, twiddling pudgy fingers and wagging his fat head dramatically. Maria Henken, indeed. My lip curled as I surveyed the dining hall for perhaps the 50th time in 3 days. Take Professor Davis and his little girl, for instance, who had been on our train and ridden up in the station wagon with Rice and me Friday afternoon. A hawk-nosed man in his late 30s, Davis was a widower, and his fortified black eyes softened only when he addressed his daughter. His eyes were soft now as he cut up a piece of chicken for the child, and his Midwestern voice was a caressing murmur as he said something to her across the table. The child, a pallid little thing of 10 or 11, small for her age, and shy almost to mutism, watched her father with large, luminous eyes. Her right arm, recently fractured in some playground mishap, was in sling, and the triangle of black silk that narrowed to her chin intensified her pallor. Then there were the Mrs. Alicia and Althea Ogilvy, gaunt, gray-haired twins nearing 60, addicted to long khaki skirts, mannish coats, and floppy straw hats. They came up from Norfolk each year at this time, it was May, to paint the laurel blossoms which lay like snow over the spur hills about the camp. Of forbidding aspect in the mornings, the Mrs. Ogilvy, I had noted, mellowed amazingly by dinner time. Annie, the raw-boned mountain woman who cleaned the rooms, ascribed this mellowness to bottles of gin which she informed me resentfully the Mrs. Ogilvy kept locked in their trunks. And finally there were the Hinkles, John and Martha, as thoroughly anesthetized by love as any bride and groom I have ever seen. Their assault on the chicken was punctuated by long, ineffable looks. John Hinkle, big, blonde, serious, was a telephone company official from somewhere in Delaware. Martha was dark, sleepy-eyed, exotic. Her figure, as outlined by a sweater suit, was something a man might die for. And Hinkle was obviously ready to make the supreme sacrifice at a moment's notice. And that was all our company, aside from the servants and Oliver Sparklet, the owner, manager, desk clerk, social secretary of Camp Greenwood, pink of cheek and oppressive with innkeeper's charm. My eyes returned to Martin Rice, now scowling at his plate. A tiny gamecock of a man, white hair rising from his narrow skull like an angry crest. a face ever ridden by the memory of that night in London when a stray bomb whistling down through the clouds like a satanic judgment had taken his wife, his daughter, and his left arm. A shadow at my shoulder, a whiff of eau de cologne introduced Oliver Sparklet. He treated Rice and me to a heavenly smile. Rice grunted in pure, unadulterated ill humor. I raised an eyebrow.
"You'll join the picnic, of course," Sparklet beamed.
"Not interested," this from Rice in clipped accents of disapproval.
I said, "Picnic?" "We go each Sunday afternoon to Lycand Rock," explained Sparklet alluringly. "I cook the steaks myself."
"Who's going?" I made it offhand.
"Everyone,"
Sparklet included the whole dining hall in a womanish wave of his plump hands.
"You go," snapped Rice at me. "I have work."
"In that case," I cut in, disappointed, "I'd better."
"I said you were to go, Potts."
It was a command. I flushed. But I was, for Camp Greenwood's benefit, Rice's secretary, so what could I say? I nodded to Sparklet. He passed on to the Ogilvies, who accepted with old maidenish squeals of delight. Rice stuck out his single, blue-veined hand.
"Give me the report."
He had sense enough to keep his voice down. I shook my head. His eyes flamed.
"Give me that report."
His voice rose. I quickly glanced around the dining hall. No one was watching. I whipped out the master copy as surreptitiously as possible, thrust it at him under the table. He got up, stuffing the dozen typewritten sheets into his coat pocket. I jumped up and followed him outside, boiling. On the flagstone veranda, he faced me, peppering me with short, hot words before I could tell him what I thought of his idiotic action in the dining room. He made it very clear that he looked upon Caspier and me as imbeciles, that our fears concerning the Gestapo were childish, that he, Mortimer Rhys Eccles, resented this 3-day seclusion under the name of Martin Rice, and that his opinion of our government intelligence and counter-espionage services was... I interrupted angrily, reminding him that future British policy would be vitally affected by the report, that any Axis agent would give his ears for a 5-minute perusal of it. "Furthermore," I threw at him, "that report may eventually affect my country as well as yours. I can't permit you to take chances." He subsided to a tone of quiet contempt. With exaggerated deference, he told me that he simply intended to sit in his room and review it in detail, that my presence would only distract him, that if there were any last-minute changes, we could make them together that night. I agreed to join the picnic on 2 conditions. The first, that everyone else in camp went. The second, that he would promise to lock both the hall door of our 2-room suite and the French window giving on our private porch. He exploded into an exasperated affirmative and stalked off to the big guest cabin. I rejoined the others in the lounge of the main lodge, and at 3:30 we all went down to the guest cabin for blankets and wraps. Rhys Eccles had been as good as his word. The door was locked. He unlocked it peevishly, returned to his big chair, and lost himself immediately in the report. On my way out, I closed the door and rattled the knob suggestively until I heard him stamp across the floor and turn the key. We straggled lazily up to Lycand Rock, only 0.5 mile from camp. From the rock, the forest dropped away beneath us to Wheat's Valley, and the valley stretched like a toy panorama into the warm afternoon haze. We loafed in the ripe sunlight. Little Effie Davis climbed around the rock, followed by her father's anxious eyes. The Ogilvies sketched. The Hinkles disappeared hand in hand up a leafy side trail, returning while Sparklet and I were laying a fire under a grill set into a cleft of the rock. In the dying rays of the sun, we ate our excellent meal. 2 incidents marred the party. Little Effie Davis complained, in her semi-audible whisper, of a tummy pain. Miss Althea Ogilvy solicitously insisted upon accompanying the child back to camp, ordering Professor Davis to stay and enjoy himself. Overwhelmed, Professor Davis gave in.
The other incident came about 3/4 of an hour later, just as a golden moon rim showed in Gunstock Gorge. Heavy feet crashed along the trail. Someone was running, gasping. A raw-boned Annie burst into the circle of firelight, an apparition of disheveled hair and wild eyes. Her first dozen words sent Davis and me streaking back to camp, plunging recklessly ahead by the wavering beam of a flashlight I had snatched from Sparklet. Annie's words sent us first to Davis's suite on the second floor of the guest cabin. Miss Althea Ogilvy hovered distractedly over the bed. On the bed lay little Effie Davis, cheeks like skimmed milk, a great purple bruise down one side of her small face. Davis bent over the child. Miss Ogilvy, almost incoherent from terror and gin, blurted out her tale. She had brought Effie back, laid her on the bed. The child, already better, had sipped water, declined medicine, quickly dozed off. Miss Ogilvy had gone to her own room, next to the Davis suite, and sat there with the door open in case Effie should awake and call out. Downstairs, she could hear Mr. Rice moving about. Some 15 minutes later, Effie had appeared at Miss Ogilvy's door, a handkerchief tied peasant fashion around her head, a doll in her good arm. She said she was all right and was going downstairs and play on the front veranda. Miss Ogilvy heard her go down the steps. Almost immediately there was a cry, a rustling noise, another cry, then the sound of running feet. Rushing down, Miss Ogilvy had found Effie lying unconscious near the foot of the stairs, the handkerchief torn from her head and exposing the great bruise. Her assailant was nowhere to be seen, nor could Miss Ogilvy tell which way he ran out. Miss Ogilvy had run down the hall to our suite to seek help from Mr. Rice. The door was open. Mr. Rice was in the big chair, apparently asleep. She had shaken him by the shoulder several times until she realized. Then she had screamed until Annie ran down from the main lodge. Together they got Effie, now mumbling something about a big man who had struck her, upstairs again, and Annie had run for Lichened Rock. I left Miss Ogilvy, dived downstairs to our suite. Rhys Eccles was quite dead. His scrawny throat rasped reddish-brown by whatever had strangled him. 3 minutes of frantic searching convinced me that the Rhys Eccles report was gone. Not that I didn't have a carbon copy in the money belt around my waist, but what good now? I left Rhys Eccles to his calm contemplation of the ceiling and tore for the main lodge and its telephone. It took me 5 dancing, cursing minutes to get through to Caspier in Washington. He mumbled something about a military plane and said he'd be at the Lynchburg airport in less than 3 hours. I ran to the servants' quarters and snatched Joe, the Negro handyman chauffeur, away from his supper with the rotund black cook, ordering him to get out the station wagon at once. Fortunately, he knew the airport. As I hurried back to the guest cabin, the station wagon whizzed past me and its taillight sank away down the mountainside like a falling star. Circling Rhys Eccles' still figure in a second and more thorough search of our rooms, I found nothing of importance. In his steamer trunk, insolently undisturbed, were the 300-odd typewritten reports which his fine machine of a mind had condensed, in 3 days and nights, into the Rhys Eccles report, for which His Majesty's government was waiting impatiently. I dropped helplessly into a chair and lit a cigarette. It seemed impossible that I had known Rhys Eccles, and Colonel Caspier, too, for only 4 days. It seemed more like years. My West Coast assignment had ended in a blaze of glory the previous Tuesday when Weber had walked into my arms in the lobby of a San Francisco movie theater, a stroke of dumb luck. That afternoon I was ordered back to Washington. I boarded the plane, determined to ask for a transfer to propaganda the minute I hit the Capitol. I'd done enough in Frisco to convince me that counter-espionage was not my racket. Captain Ed Bell, my immediate superior, met the plane at the Washington airport Thursday morning. He stuck out his hand.
"Nice going, Kettle. I thought you told me you'd never make an intelligence man."
"Pure dumb luck," I said it wearily, knowing he wouldn't believe me.
"Horse feathers,"
he clapped me on the shoulder. He looked around. The other passengers were almost to the gate.
Caspier wants you, he said, half under his breath. I've got your orders here.
He shook his head as I extended my hand.
Verbal orders.
Who's Caspier? I'd never heard the name before. What does he want me for?
I don't know. Bell was embarrassed. As near as I can find out, it's a new department. Hush-hush as hell. Kind of a bastard by Treasury out of state. Some sort of liaison tie-up with the British. Overlaps into CE work now and then. I know one thing, though.
Go on, I said grimly.
Caspier's the white-haired boy around Washington just now, said Bell,
with interdepartmental jealousy.
What he asks for, he gets. Took Williams and McCreary off us last week.
What are they doing now? I was startled. They were top men in our line. Bell blushed.
I don't know. He looked around again. At least I'm not supposed to.
He bent even closer to me.
I did think I saw Williams this morning, he said darkly. Driving a cab. What do you think of that?
How are my chances of getting into propaganda? I said hastily. Bell stiffened officially.
Here are your orders, Kettle.
When he finished his spiel, I just looked at him. His mouth twitched.
No kidding, he said,
and walked off. So I took a cab downtown and caught a bus. When I reached a certain corner, I got off and ambled along a row of old, tall, brownstone houses until I found the number Bell had given me. A colored houseboy in a white coat answered my ring. It seemed to be a boarding house. But as the boy led me up to the second floor, I noticed a bulge on his right hip. At the foot of the dark wood stairway leading to the third floor, he stopped, jerked his thumb upward.
Last door down, boss.
His accent was of an uneducated Virginia Negro, but...
New York University, I said on impulse.
His puzzled look made me feel like a fool. Then he smiled and shook his head. The puzzled look had been an act.
Columbia Law School, he said, smiling and turned away.
Still following Bell's instructions, I mounted to the third floor, entered the door at the end without knocking, to find myself in a crudely equipped office that obviously had once been a bedroom. There was an inner door. It was shut. I was reaching for its knob when a man's voice, high, neighing, gusty with passion, cut through its flimsy panels.
"Where did you put 'em?"
demanded his neighing voice. I stopped dead. A woman's voice, low, angry, answered.
"Where you won't find 'em, and you know why."
Brief silence, during which I could visualize the antagonists glaring at one another. The man's voice went up a quarter octave.
"I order you to tell me!"
"Fiddlesticks!"
High heels clicked across the inner room. I jumped back and to one side. The door flew open and a tall woman flounced out. A second glance showed her to be a superb blonde, beautifully turned out, probably 30. Under her plentiful but skillfully applied makeup, her face was scarlet with anger. To my amazement, she flung herself down at a typewriter desk and began to pound the keys of an old Underwood. I coughed introductively. She looked around quickly.
"Who are you?"
she demanded pettishly. This was too much.
"I'm beginning to wonder," I barked.
"Then you must be Mike Kettle," she retorted. "What are you waiting for? He's in there."
She shrugged a shapely shoulder toward the half-open door, whereupon she ignored me and the Underwood began to chatter like a mad thing. The doorway filled slowly with a man. From a small, precise mouth set in a great moon face, the same neighing voice, now controlled and courteous as a politician's, said,
"Welcome to Section 5, Lieutenant."
Momentarily speechless, I bowed.
"Come in."
The figure turned on its heel, showing a back broad as a barn door. I paused irresolutely in the doorway, hand on the knob. A swiveled chair squealed in agony as the owner of the neighing voice dropped into it.
"Don't bother to close the door," said Colonel Caspier with some bitterness. "She'll only listen at the keyhole."
The typewriter had stopped. Behind me, the blonde woman snorted contemptuously.
Caspier waved a fat hand toward a straight wooden chair and, as I sat down, lost himself in thought, eyes closed. I seized the opportunity to take stock of my new boss. Weight about 280, but the fat hands and round face make him look tubbier than he really is, I decided. Suit of good tweeds, expensive shirt, grotesque tie. But untidy. Looks as if he'd been held down and clothes put on him by force.
"Nursemaid job," said Caspier suddenly, eyes opening full on mine. "You can typewrite, can't you?"
"I was an editorial writer on The Sun," I replied with dignity, then a forlorn hope. "That is why propaganda is really my..."
"Lots of reports," said Caspier. "Took 'em months. Their men, our men, working together."
This meant nothing. I noticed his teeth were stained as though with tobacco juice.
"This feller Reese Eccles'll do it, though,"
continued Caspier, nodding solemnly in admiration of Reese Eccles.
"All brain, no brawn."
He smacked his lips.
"Put 'em all together. That's where you come in."
His voice trailed off. I realized incredulously that he believed he had told me everything, that my instructions were now complete, and that the interview was over.
"Oh!"
Caspier's face lighted up, his middle finger snapped against his pulpy palm like a small firecracker. He had remembered something.
"Henkin!"
"Henkin?" I don't know why I bothered to ask. I suspected that the answer would mean nothing, and it did.
"Yep, Henkin."
Caspier was impatient now. He jiggled in the swivel chair, which cursed him.
"People over there,"
he waved in the direction of the rising sun, "give a good deal for Reese Eccles' results, of course. We've heard some woman named Henkin is due to try for 'em. You'll have to watch out."
His train of thought was obviously miles past me, but I leaped figuratively for the caboose.
"May I have a description of this Henkin woman?" He leaned forward, highly pleased at my grasp on the matter in hand.
"None available," he said, staging a pantomime with fingers and head to describe the utter unavailability of a description of the woman Henkin. "Just have to do the best."
"Where do I—" I began desperately. If white-coated attendants had rushed in and thrown Caspier into a straitjacket at that moment, it would not have raised a single pulse beat of surprise in me. Caspier rose, all 6.5 feet of him.
"Reese Eccles demands quiet, no distractions. Camp Greenwood, got tickets here."
He rummaged in his pants pockets.
"He'll be Martin Rice, author. You'll be Potts, his secretary."
Still digging deep.
"Get it? Your name's Kettle. You'll use Potts. Easy to remember."
A laugh rumbled up from his ample belly. Both hands came up clutching wads of what looked like waste paper, and a roll of greenbacks tumbled to the floor. Caspier frowned down at it.
"Maud!" he bawled.
Neither of us had seen the blonde woman poised statuesquely in the doorway. Now she stepped forward with a purposeful swing of her rangy hips. She retrieved the money, slapped it down on the desk. From Caspier's hands, she snatched the crumpled papers. She sorted them swiftly, efficiently, and handed me 2 railroad tickets. She faced Caspier.
"May I put in a dime's worth now?"
she inquired, plucked eyebrows arched.
"Why, of course."
Caspier was genuinely hurt at the implication that he was a petty tyrant. Maud turned fine brown eyes on me.
"A joint British and American commission has just completed a survey of our war industries,"
she said.
"Potential production, potential aid to Britain, that sort of thing. Dull but extremely important."
I sighed with relief as the room's atmosphere became tinged with sanity.
"It adds up to 300-odd separate reports,"
went on Maud.
"They need a digest of this material in London at once. Reese Eccles is a political economist and a bit of a mental freak. They brought him along just for the job. He's to go off to some quiet place with these reports. They say that in 3 days he'll be able to come up with a 4,000 or 5,000-word summation, which will give the British government a basis for immediate formulation of policy. Section 5 has been assigned to look after Rhys Eccles. We're sending him up to Camp Greenwood in the Blue Ridge. You'll go along to do his typing, give him whatever assistance you can, and see that he lives to finish the job.
Caspier was pacing up and down, inspecting his fingernails. I told him all that, he put in, bored. Keep him alive, I said.
Just this, said Maud. The Gestapo people most certainly know of the Commission's work. We have reason to believe they're keeping an eye on Rhys Eccles. We even have information that an agent named Maria Henken has been assigned to obtain his summary. About Maria Henken, we know nothing.
Nothing! Neighed Caspier from the window with gloomy pleasure.
Rhys Eccles is at the Tort Hotel under the name of Martin Rice. You'll be George Potts, his secretary. Pick him up tonight at 8. Your train leaves at 8:30. Take a portable typewriter, of course. You'll find Rhys Eccles difficult. Put up with him as best you can, and if anything should happen...
Call me, said Caspier over his shoulder. I scribbled down the private number Maud gave me.
Now run along and be a good boy,
ordered this surprising woman, bestowing a motherly kiss on my forehead as she pushed me gently toward the door. The kiss sent a tingle down to my heels. Outside in the hall, I paused to stuff the tickets into my wallet. Now, I heard Caspier say menacingly, where did you put 'em? Maud's voice was full of shrewish satisfaction.
I threw 'em, every one of 'em, out the window.
Caspier's shrill moan rattled the door. The whole box? He screamed.
If you think with your figure, said Maud acidly, that you're going to sit in that office and stuff down those nauseating chocolate cherries all day.
I hurried away to preserve what remained of my reason. The Negro houseboy, Columbia Law graduate, let me out. His intelligent mouth broadened at my dazed expression. But his good day, sir, was strictly in character. That was how I met Colonel Stephen Caspier, the strange head of Section 5. Now I sat beside Rhys Eccles's cooling corpse. Voices in the night told of the return of the rest of the picnic party. I went out to take charge of things until Caspier arrived. I relayed Miss Ogilvy's account of the attack on Effie Davis and the finding of Rhys Eccles's body to Colonel Caspier as soon as we had laid him on the bed in Rhys Eccles's room. It was 2 a.m., and he had just arrived, wobbling into the guest cabin supported by Maud, resplendent in mink over a dazzling dinner gown, and Joe the chauffeur. Caspier was in full evening dress, very rumpled, and there were spots on his shirt front. Maud said crisply to Joe,
Bicarbonate of soda, plenty of it.
She turned to me.
Plane sick all the way from Washington. When he got out at Lynchburg, he got ground sick. In the station wagon, he was car sick.
She wheeled on Caspier, who lay with his eyes shut, his broad face the color of a mud beach at low tide.
Have a chocolate cherry?
She cooed cruelly, throwing off the mink wrap and filling the room with the glitter of sequins.
Well, what happened, Kettle?
So I told everything. Caspier struggled up on an elbow. His eyes were on the sheeted figure in the big chair, but I could feel him listening. When I got through, he rolled himself to the edge of the bed. Maud smoothed the sequins over her hips.
Well, she said to Caspier, what about it, Steve? Do we form a posse and beat the woods for the masked intruder?
Caspier pursed his lips contemptuously. When he spoke, it was to me an unintelligible mumbling accompanied by a village idiot waving of the hands.
In English, said Maud resignedly, that means, where is everybody now?
Professor Davis and Effie are in the room overhead, of course, I replied. The others are all in their rooms. The Ogilvies are next to the Davises. The Hinkles, that's the bride and groom, are in the suite next to this one. The servants are in their own quarters. Sparklet, the owner, has rooms at the main lodge. I told him to stay there. Caspier spoke clearly now.
What else did you do?
Not a thing except call you, I returned defensively. Murder's not in my line. My specialty is propaganda. Caspier chuckled delightedly.
We'll make something of Kettle yet.
He was on his feet now, a monolith of black broadcloth and smudged line. The weakness seemed to have passed.
I hope so, I said sourly. Something in propaganda preferred. Balderdash, said Caspier good-naturedly. You haven't seen a lady bareback rider in camp, have you?
Not a spangle of one. What could you do but humor the big maniac? Unless it's Mrs. Hinkle, why?
Hinkle, said Caspier. First name?
Martha.
Hmm, he addressed the silent Maud. Heard today that the Henkin female used to be a circus performer.
His bulk became suddenly animated, so unexpectedly that Maud and I both jumped. He minced over to the big chair and twitched the sheet from Rhys Eccles with a magician's flourish. Bending with a grunt, he peered into the dead man's face. Then he drew a forefinger down the stiff left cheek like a man sampling wet paint and stared myopically at the fingertip, clucking softly to himself. I glanced sardonically at Maud. To my surprise, her expression was no longer scornful. She was watching Caspier intently. Caspier flung the sheet carelessly over Rhys Eccles's peaked face and turned to the paneled wall beside the chair, his back to us. The next instant, he walked with short steps over to the French windows and flung them open, sticking his head into the night, still clucking. He withdrew his head after a minute and slammed the French window. A pane of glass fell in gleaming shards at his feet.
Clumsy, eh?
He was beaming. He looked at the big chair.
Poor little guy. Not much to live for now except his job. Done that.
He addressed me directly.
Keep Maud amused. Gotta see some people.
And he left the room, apparently under the impression that because he was tiptoeing, he was making no noise. The door banged behind him like a studio sound effect. Maud looked pityingly at me.
You're bearing up better than most, she said. He gave one man Shane Stokes breathing.
She passed me slowly in an aura of gardenia perfume and once more brushed my forehead with her lips. Again I tingled. She sat down on Rhys Eccles's bed, crossing her admirable legs.
Listen, she said.
So we listened, and my muddled brain conceived the notion that Rhys Eccles was listening, too. I had a feeling that if I removed that sheet, I would find a mocking smile on his thin lips. Colonel Caspier was very busy. We needed no television set to follow his progress through the guest cabin. He clumped up the steps and went to the Davis's suite, directly overhead first. His chat with Professor Davis was mild and brief. Next, we heard him knocking at the Ogilvy's door and for a few minutes, high, harsh, undistinguishable words caromed about the whole cabin. The door slammed. Then the stairway shook again and he pounded on the Hinkle's door down the hall from us. He involved himself in a neighing altercation with John Hinkle that gradually simmered into whispers. Next, he poked his head in our door and Maud, after a long look at the grimace on his face, got up.
Come on, he neighed gaily. We're all going up to Effie's room.
I'll never forget that brief quarter hour in Effie's room, which was really her father's. In the first place, it was strangely like a courtroom, with the child herself propped up in bed, chalk white except for the bruised area on her face as the judge. A little red wrapper around her shoulders hid most of the long-sleeved, old-fashioned nightgown she wore. The white edge of the plaster cast around her right wrist framed the wrist like a cuff inside the black silk sling. Caspier sat mountainously on the bed beside her, fingering a heavy oak walking stick belonging to Professor Davis. As the company straggled in, the Ogilvy's heavy-eyed but apparently sober, the Hinkle's oddly apprehensive, I noticed that Professor Davis shifted, too casually, to a position beside John Hinkle and that Hinkle was breathing hard. Caspier drew a bead on John Hinkle with the walking stick.
"Left the picnic a while, didn't you?"
he asked unpleasantly. His blue eyes glinted.
"Effie,"
he said very gently, his other hand touching the child's thin shoulder,
"Mr. Hinkle was the man you saw leaving Mr. Rice's room, the man who knocked you down, wasn't he?"
Effie's eyes were riveted on Hinkle. We could barely hear her.
"Yes."
Hinkle's laugh was a feeble effort.
"I want," said Caspier with flute-like clarity, "that report."
But Hinkle was gone, tearing himself from Professor Davis's frantic grasp, upending an Ogilvy sister as he dived for the hall. Davis was after him like a fighting hound. Caspier, clutching the oak stick, materialized beside me and shot after them, screaming, "Close the door!" I ran after Caspier, jerking the door shut. Davis and Hinkle were struggling on the floor at the head of the stairs as Caspier and I reached them, a tangle of thrashing fists and feet. Caspier took what I instantly saw to be very bad aim with the walking stick. Before I could catch his arm, it hissed downward, a dull sound of wood on scalp and bone.
"Ah!"
said Caspier, straightening himself and looking down at the unconscious figure of Professor Davis. He stretched out a long arm, helped Hinkle up.
"Stay with him,"
he said to Hinkle, indicating the prone Davis.
"Also,"
he added, turning away,
"thanks."
We re-entered the bedroom. I was quite resigned now. Somebody was crazy. I only hoped it was Caspier and not me. Caspier lumbered over to the bed.
"Your father's quite safe, Effie."
His ironical tone was like a slap at the child's face. An Ogilvy sister stepped forward angrily. Maud held her back.
"Let me see that arm of yours, Effie," demanded Caspier, stretching out his left hand.
His right still gripped the stick. Then I went sick inside, for Caspier snatched the plaster-casting closed arm from its black silk sling and was battering the plaster to pieces with the handle of the walking stick. I can't remember the rest in detail, but I do remember something flashing in Effie's free hand and Caspier screaming, "Little devil!" and his great hand shaking out and closing around her little throat. Then there was turmoil among the spectators as Caspier and the child flopped across the bed in an absurd, squirming battle that was awkward but deadly. It ended with Caspier flinging Effie heavily against the headboard. The impact dazed her. We crowded around the bed as Caspier rolled off and got to his feet. I heard Maud gasp. The Ogilvy sisters clung to each other, whimpering. The struggle had ripped away the upper portion of Effie's nightgown. A single glance explained many things to me. Why Effie always wore long-sleeved dresses and little cape-like coats, why she spoke in a whisper, why woolen stockings always encased her spindly legs. For Effie Davis was a woman. Her torso, bare, made that very plain, and her thin arms were weirdly muscular. A midget, if you like, but a woman. Caspier paid no attention to her, even when she stirred, sat up, and cursed him shamelessly in a shrill, evil voice. He was plucking bits of plaster from the Reese Eccles report, newly freed from the plaster cast that had encircled Effie's broken arm. He said quietly,
"I suppose that thing out in the hall is your husband, eh, Maria?"
Effie's reply, describing her relationship to Davis, was unprintable.
"Handkerchief business, you see, of course,"
mumbled Caspier thickly through a ham sandwich. He gulped two mouthfuls of scalding coffee.
"Powder on the old boy's cheek, that gin-swizzling female don't use it. Clean plaster on cast, too. And porch. Got that?"
Maud's sequins rattled venomously as she tossed pad and pencil to the bed, lit a cigarette, and fixed Caspier with a grim, uncompromising eye.
"Tell it straight and I'll take it down,"
was her ruthless ultimatum. The relaxed hulk of Caspier filled the big chair lately vacated by Mortimer Rhys Eccles, who had been removed and deposited on the bed in my room. The Hinkles were present by invitation. Upstairs, the Ogilvies slumbered alcoholically. Behind the main lodge, we knew, Annie and Joe sat with shotguns before the strong door of the vegetable dugout, serving as a detention cell for Maria Effie Davis Hankin and her father. Caspier looked diffidently at Maud. "Oh, all right," he said mildly. He put the sandwich down, leaned forward. Maud reached for the pad, poised the pencil above it in her slender, crimson-nailed fingers. "Little she Judas strangled Rhys Eccles, of course," began Caspier. "See a lot of midgets doing bareback stuff, acrobatics in circuses around Germany, Poland, Hungary. Old Miss Gin Swizzler lays Fraulein Judas on bed after coming back from picnic. Miss Gin Swizzler goes to own room. Little she Judas eases out of bed, slips off plaster cast, slides down porch support to Rhys Eccles's porch." He nodded toward the French windows. "Taps on window," he said. "Who'd Rhys Eccles open French window for but a child? Lost his own in London. Likes children. They probably knew that, reason they used little Judas Devil. He opens window, lets her in, sits down in chair. She, affectionate, goes coyly around back of chair, slips arm around his neck. About time Rhys Eccles begins to wonder where plaster cast on arm is, little she Judas tightens arm around his neck, braces herself against back of chair. You saw that arm, like wire rope." Maud's pencil flew across her pad. The Hinkles were hunched forward in their chairs. "Garrotted, Rhys Eccles was, by that little arm. But he fought, banged Fraulein Judas's head against wall, but he caved in. She took report, shinnied back up to own room, unlocking hall door of this room before she left. Face badly bruised, though. Must be explained somehow. Ties handkerchief around head to hide bruise, replaces cast on arm, goes to old Miss Gin, tells her she's going out to play. Goes downstairs, stamps feet, cries out, tears handkerchief off, lies down, swears she's been struck down by mysterious man. Bruise visible now. Ha! Simple. Rests easy. Davis and little she Judas get rid of old cast, make new one around Rhys Eccles' report. Powder was giveaway. Fraulein Judas had to powder up to look pale and frail. Left some on Rhys Eccles' cheek when she—" here Caspier was human enough to shudder— "cuddled her cheek against his. Also some on wall when face banged against it. And how could child with broken arm tie handkerchief around head unless she used broken arm?"
"But why that scene with Mr. Hinkle out here?" I protested.
"Davis armed," growled Caspier. "Wary, too. She told him Hinkle was man, get ready to help. Very pleased, too, Davis was. Wonder what Davis's real name is. Maybe Washington knows."
He yawned cavernously. The Hinkles got up, silent.
"Sit down," ordered Caspier hospitably. They sat. "Chat with Maud and friend Kettle Potts here." He glanced at his watch. "We leave at daylight, and that's only an hour."
He yawned again.
"Little nap,"
he murmured apologetically and ambled into the next room.
"There's only one bed in there," I called hastily, cringing at the thought of what reposed on that bed.
Caspier turned benignly in the doorway.
"Won't disturb him," he said, drawing the door to close behind him.
Through the closed door we heard the bed creak.
"Move over, old boy," said Colonel Caspier.
Then all was serene.